So, karma, it's choice. We'll come to why it's choice in a minute. But just to put this talk in the context, as many of you know, this is a talk in a series of talks on what are called the four reminders or the four mind-turning reflections. And this is the third of the reminder or the mind-turning reflection that we are encouraged to think about, reflect on. And I will say a bit more about it during the talk. But before I go into why reflecting on karma or the concept of karma can be a useful thing, let's be clear about what we mean by karma, because it's one of those words like guru and some other words, samsara, nirvana, which have become very much part of our vocabulary. They've kind of entered the Western colloquial language. In the English-speaking world, but it's not always quite clear what they actually mean, and different people can mean very different things with these words. So karma. So I think it'd be interesting to hear just what associations people have this with this word karma, and what you might think it means. So the experience Buddhists, please don't interfere, because you'll give away the answer. So let's hear. What do you think karma means? Any words associated with karma?
You reap what you sow.
You reap what you sow, yeah. Anything else?
I think when something, you're walking along and something happens to you, you think, my goodness, that's happened before.
Hmm.
Karma, perhaps?
Okay. On that basis. Like a kind of repetition of something that's happened, yeah, okay.
In a Western context, it's often seen as kind of like a divine justice.
Divine justice, yeah. Like a retribution or a justice, yeah. Yeah, it can be used in that kind of way, yeah. Any others?
Actions,
yeah. Yeah.
Cause and effect,
cause and effect, yeah. Okay, I mean, I did a Google search of the word karma, and I looked at the images, and there's some of these posters that come up. So I'm just going to read one or two of them, some of them. So one is, keep calm and let karma finish it. The other one is, no need for revenge, just sit back and wait. Those who hurt you will eventually screw up themselves, and if you're lucky, God will let you watch. It's under the heading of karma. Dear karma, I have a list of people you missed. Welcome to Karma Cafe. There are no menus. You will get what you deserve. So on. It goes on and on. There's loads of them here. It's obviously a word which has many different connotations. But in the Buddhist context, it's always been used in a very particular way. And that's why I want to firstly clarify what it actually means in the Buddhist context. So I think it's good to start with the word itself. So the word karma is a Sanskrit word. In Pali, it's called kamma, and it literally means action. So it doesn't mean the fruit of an action or result of an action, as it's often used or thought to mean. It literally just means action, and not just any kind of action. It actually, what it means is the consciously willed action. So if you have a action that is automatic, like breathing, or I don't know, you're walking along and you step on an ant which you didn't even know was there. That's not really karma. Karma is action which has a conscious intention and a volition behind it. So that's very, very important distinction that is made in Buddhism about what it means by karma. And there's a very frequent definition that's given to explain karma. And what that says is, karma equals chetana. And you might say, well, that's not very helpful. What does chetana mean? So chetana basically means volition. So what it's saying, so I think that again emphasizes what we, so it's not to realize, to understand whether an action is a karmic action from Buddhist point of view, we have to look at the mental state behind it and whether it was a consciously willed action or it was just some kind of automatic reaction or an automatic action. So again, and that is different from, so it is said that karma or the consciously willed actions have a result, and the result or the fruit of the action is what's called karma vipaka, literally fruit of an action. Now, I think it becomes a bit easier to understand the Buddhist emphasis on the state of mind behind the action if we look at this word in a historical context. So at the Buddha was teaching in ancient India, which was very much permeated by concepts which are nowadays associated with Hinduism. And it was what's called the Brahminical tradition or the Vedantic tradition. And something that's very strong in the Vedas or the Vedantic or the Hindu tradition is that actions have consequences, but it's almost like it's the action itself. So, for example, it is encouraged that you bathe in the river Ganges, but it doesn't matter what your state of mind is, but just the bathing in the river Ganges will purify you of all your sins and all your bad deeds, and you can go out and do a few more. So, or just giving money to or feeding 20 Brahmins will do the trick, you know. So it's the action itself that's held as the most important thing. But what the Buddha was trying to do was say, no, actually, it's not just the action itself, but it's the state of mind that action originates from. That is the key there. That's the important thing. And in particularly whether that action springs from a state of mind of greed, hatred, and delusion, or does it spring from a state of mind of clarity, love and compassion, of wisdom? And that is the key distinction which decides whether that karmic action is positive or negative, or skillful or unskillful. So it was a state of mind that determined whether the action is going to have a good effect for you, not simply feeding 20 Brahmins or bathing in the river Ganges or going through the motions as we might do, you know, that's not what's going to result in good or bad effect. So, I mean, this notion isn't too far-fetched for us either. I mean, most of us can, I'm sure, relate to it. There's a quote I like, and I was trying to find who this quote is by, and it's attributed to at least 6 different people just searching on the internet. I'll just read it out. So it's attributed to everyone from the ancient Chinese sage Lao Tzu to Ralph Waldo Emerson and many other people in between. And it's the same quote, more or less the same quote. And the quote goes, sow a thought and you reap an action. Sow an act and you reap a habit. Sow a habit and you reap a character. Sow a character and you reap a destiny. It's sometimes put in other words, which is something like, watch your thoughts for they become words. Watch your words for they become actions. Watch your actions for they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character for it becomes your destiny. And there was another version of this which just began with the actions, so the thoughts wasn't there. So starting with sow an action and you reap a habit. So that would be kind of more kind of the Hindu, in a way, philosophy or superficial reading of karma. But what the Buddha brought was that the state of mind behind it. So sow a thought, it's the intention behind the action which determines the quality of the action and whether that's ethical or unethical. I mean, we make a distinction of that even in our legal system. I mean, the full premeditated murder is a very different thing from what's called manslaughter. You know, it's the end result is someone dying, but it's quite a difference whether that was a act of intention versus something that maybe happened by accident. But there may have been carelessness involved, but that's still not the same as the intention. intention of a premeditated murder. So that's a very extreme negative example. You could think of other examples. You know, it's like, I know you might just give to someone because you feel you want to get rid of them. It's like, I grew up in India, there's lots of beggars around. And you know, a lot of people just give to beggars just because they just want to get rid of them. It's not that you feel the compassion or you feel, oh, this poor human being, there he is. It's just, you just want them out of your way. And that's why people give. So it's the same act. And maybe to the beggar, it doesn't matter too much in the end whether he gets $5 for the reason. But I think it does matter to the person. And it has an effect on us, whether we give just out of aversion or out of genuine compassion. So that's a positive example. There's a very well-known set of verses called the Dhammapada. It's considered one of the earliest of Buddhist scriptures, Buddhist literature. And these words are what begin this piece of literature. So these are verses called the pairs, and I'll just read four of them out. So experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. But that again is the same, emphasizing the Buddha here is emphasizing the whole thing begins with our mind, what the effect on ourselves and on the world, and that's what the karma, in a way, asks us to consider. It's like go back to the source of your action, of actions of body, speech, and mind, and they all spring from the mind, and they have an effect. So we see in these verses, we see there's a definite linkage between pure states of mind, which are, as I had said before, states of mind which are free from greed, hatred, and delusion, and therefore you could say states of mind that are rooted in love and compassion, in clarity, in real understanding. It is said those lead to happiness, to good for ourselves and others. I mean, isn't that strange? Why should that be so? You know, it's like, why is the universe structured that way? Or do we even believe that that really happens? So that's something to reflect on. I think one way to reflect on it is to consider the effect on, I mean, it's hard to see what effects action have over a long, you know, over a long period or on any action, what any action has, all the effects it has. But it is what we can observe is the effect it has on ourselves, and at least on the immediate surrounding. Now, I know if I go to work in a very grumpy state, and I just kind of react to what people are saying, that has an effect on others, but it also has an effect on me. I feel more kind of, I feel constricted, unhappy. It's like it doesn't feel good. As opposed to when I act out of more clarity and mindfulness and a sense of connectedness with people, hopefully others pick that up. But even if they don't, I feel a different kind of person. I feel those types of action lead to a sense of well-being and lead to happiness for me, at least for a while. So I think for me, that's one thing I can observe very, very kind of concretely in my own experience. So maybe I'll come back to that, the action and result of the actions. But I just wanted to therefore come back to some of the misconceptions that we have about that people have about this concept of karma. So karma doesn't mean destiny. Sometimes it's used in the sense of destiny. Oh, well, that's just your karma. Well, yes, karma or actions have consequences, but that doesn't mean that everything that happens to us is due to our karmic actions. The two don't follow, because there's all sorts of other things happening in the world. And here, the Buddhism, so we have to go in a way even underneath what underlies karma. And what underlies karma is even a more, what you could say, a universal principle at work, which is said to be the thing that Buddha saw upon his enlightenment. And this is generally called what's called conditionality. So the most succinct formulation of that is, this being that becomes, with the arising of this, that arises. This not being that does not become, with the ceasing of this, that ceases. And said, the Buddha says, you can see this conditionality at work in all sorts of ways, at different levels. So for example, a match and rub it against something, or bring it to a heat source and it lights up. So those conditions are necessary, a match and heat for that match to burst into flames. Those conditions have led to the flame. So that's one level of conditionality. Another type of conditionality we are familiar with is you take a seed, you give it the right condition, good soil, water, right temperature, and it bursts into a plant. So that's another level of conditionality. And then we start to get into more subtle levels of conditionality to do with our mind. So the first two levels are called technically called the uju niyama. I'm going to throw these technical words at you, but don't worry. Which basically means physical inorganic order. And the second one is bija niyama, which basically refers to the biological order. So the third one is the psychological order. And there it's things like, well, if we are brought up in a certain way by our parents, that has an effect on us. If we are brought up in a family where there's a lot of violence, that's going to affect how, to some extent, our character. It doesn't totally determine our character, but it does have an extent. So that's a cause and effect at a psychological level. And then comes what's called the ethical level. So that's where the karma niyama comes in. So the karma is one type of conditionality at work in the world, in particularly to do with consciously willed actions. So, but that doesn't mean the other conditionalities are not there. They are there too at work in the world. But what's important is the consciously willed action arising from certain state of mind has a certain effect, and that's something that's not always kind of visible to us, or something that we may not give a lot of importance to, because we're more familiar with the other levels of conditionality. So, for example, if we fall sick, well, is that my karma? It's very hard to say. It could be simply that you've gone out in the cold and you're given your body a chill. That would be just a physical example of physical conditionality. Or it could be that you had been exposed to germs, virus, through someone else who sneezed on you. So that'd be the biological. It could be that you were very stressed due to something and that led to decrease in your immune system. So that could be partly psychological. Sometimes people say, there's a big earthquake that's happened in China or wherever, and it must be bad karma. it's from a Buddhist point of view, that's nonsense, because it might just be tectonic plates shifting. Most likely, you can't just attribute things to karma. I mean, ethical actions do have consequences, but that doesn't mean you can necessarily say that take something and attribute it to karma. It's not that simple. So I'm not sure why that fell down. So, are you following me? Yeah. So it is, I know, a bit technical, but I feel it's useful to understand that the distinction Buddhism makes about this, the different order of conditionality, and to realize that the cause and effect that flows from consciously willed action is only one, you know, is a stream there. Is one stream among many. But this is where we come to karma as a choice. Because we don't have a lot of, often a lot of, may or may not have a lot of control over the other kinds of conditionality that are going on around us. You know, we may live in a country, we suddenly goes to war with someone, and it's like the whole things changes. Economic conditions change, social conditions change. There's all sorts, our own personal conditions can change. But one thing we do have some degree of control over, or can have some degree of mastery and understanding over, is our own state of mind. And therefore, even in given any circumstance, we always have a freedom there of how we react. And if we so apply this, have an understanding of karma, we know that even in the worst of circumstances, if we act from an ethical state of mind, it is going to have positive repercussions into the future, even though we may or may not be able to do very much about the immediate situation, because that's a result of a lot of things. So it's, and you know, going back to that quote, sow a thought, you reap an action, sow an act, you reap a, what was it? You reap a habit, sow a habit, you reap a character. So all these little things add up. And I think to me that also underlines the importance of habit. So we're not just talking about a good action here or good action there. What we're talking about is actually forming positive habits, because these little things add up in the long term. And you might, you know, you end up having quite a different kind of life over a period of time than if you had not done those things. So it's also something that's cumulative. I mean, it has an immediate effect. You feel the effects of you may feel the effects of a positive act, for example. But it also, repeated positive acts also have a cumulative effect over time. Okay. So I've jumped around a bit. I'll just have to see where I am in my notes. Okay. So we could ask now, where does, now that we have some understanding of what karma means within the Buddhist context, why reflect on it? Why is it included in the four reflections that this series is about? The four reminders, as it's called. Now, just for those of you who have been coming to this series, you may remember that the whole reason about the reasoning behind the four reminders is that they are something that help inspire us to practice. They help us provide the motivation to practice. So one of the quotes by Sangharakshita, who's the founder of our movement, is that a lot of the spiritual life is about finding emotional equivalents to our intellectual understanding. So we may have an intellectual understanding that meditation is good for us, acting ethically or with integrity is good for us. But how do we get the heart involved? How do we get the emotions involved? Because that's what really then makes spiritual life happen. That, you know, it's like with anything. It's like, I remember a friend of mine giving an example. He said he had a grandmother who lived in a different town, and he knew he should go and see her regularly, but he only managed it once or twice a year. And then it happened that he managed to get a girlfriend living in the same town. Mm-hmm. And he was there every weekend. So but you know, a lot of his emotions were involved so how do we get, you know, more of ourselves, our unconscious parts of us and our emotions involved in what we know intellectually to be a good thing. So these four reflections are said to be one of those things that if we reflect on repeatedly, they will have an effect on us. They will mature the mind. They will give us. They will show us that that we, you know, they'll tell us not to waste our life to put effort towards things that are of meaning in the longer term. So, just a reminder of what the four reminders are. So, first one was the precious human life. The preciousness of human life, of this opportunity that we have. Second one was about death and impermanence, that, you know, life and everything is impermanent and death is certain. The only thing uncertain is its timing. We don't know when it's going to strike, so even more emphasizes the preciousness of the opportunity we have. And also impermanence in the sense of we may have positive conditions to practice now, and even we may not die or anything in a few days, but those conditions might change. Something that may happen that takes up a lot of our time and effort, and we may not have the mind space or the time to give to the thing that we consider to be important. So that's the second reminder, the impermanence. So the third one is this one, karma and its consequences. So how does that fit in? So how does that fit in with this series? Okay. So here I'm going to give you some of my personal reflections. So until now I was talking about, you know, Buddhism and what it says about the definition of karma. But here what I'm going to talk about now is mostly my own reflection, having been a practicing Buddhist for many years, and what I feel when I reflect on karma. And I think one of the things that I've already mentioned is, to me, what it says is the fact that it gives me a lot of hope. What it says to me is, whatever situation or state I find myself in, I always have a choice. It reminds me of that. And there's always a way forward. And that way forward is about how I respond to the situation. And for that, I need to be present. I need mindfulness. And I need awareness of what's going on. And I need an understanding of myself and of maybe other people who are involved in the situation and so on. And if I have developed a habit of not responding in resentment, then that helps. So it's also a matter of forming a habit that we react in certain ways to things. And this is where things like meditation and practice of mindfulness and a conscious practice of acting ethically comes in. And some people are more kind of, you could say, natural at it. I don't know why. For example, I was thinking of Nelson Mandela. You know, that's an extreme example in a positive way. He was imprisoned by the South African government for years and held in really bad conditions, which would have broken the average human being, and yet he decided not to respond to his captors with hatred, and that was a conscious decision he made, and he was able to have that freedom even under the most trying of circumstances. And you know, there are other examples of that, some people in Nazi concentration camps and others. So you know, even in those situations, there are people who find resources to act creatively and positively. So I'm sure, you know, whatever situation we find ourselves in, or I find myself in, I should be able to react in a positive way. And also kind of trusting that reaction, that kind of response is of value and has an effect. It's not just something I do in my mind. Because, you know, we live in a very materialistic world. Things that are material seem to have more value, but in a way, what happens in our private life of our own mind is somehow we think not that important, whereas Buddhism puts it the other way around in some ways. So that's the other reflection I have, is what goes on in the private space of our mind is important. It has an effect on us and on the world. For example, I mean, if we habitually reside in a state of resentment, even though it may not always show, but we know for ourselves, or we become aware that that's what our habitual responses to a lot of situations we find ourselves in. we're in this kind of state of resentment, it's going to have an effect under the law of karma, under the order of karma. It will have an effect on us. We will be a different kind of person over a number of years, even, and most likely it will have an effect on others. So it kind of puts the onus on us to not to put up with that and make an effort to change those habitual states of mind. In a similar way, the positive habits can have strong effects as well. It's not just the negative ones. The other thing it emphasizes for me is the fact that that we can change. I mean, it's kind of covered in what I say to some extent, but you know, sometimes even I find myself thinking, "Oh, you know, I'll always be like this. I can't change." But what the law of karma, or the concept of karma, telling me is no, it is possible to change. It is genuine change is possible. It may take a while, but even in the most trying of circumstances, it is possible to change because we can work on our mind. I've got a poem here which kind of talks about something like that. It's called Lost. So lost in the sequence of words, some predetermined story on a printed page. But look in between the lines, those jumbled scribbling lines. And you will slowly find, a vast, exhilarating, and sacred space. So it is, and it's this, the fact of karma that makes that opening of that space possible. So one more reflection. The karma also brings home to me that the Buddhist ethics is not just about not doing bad or unskillful things. It's also about changing myself so I'm actually doing the positive things. Because sometimes I think ethics can be thought of just purely in the sense of not doing the negative. So I shouldn't, you know, be bad to that person. I shouldn't steal. I shouldn't tell a lie. And that's all fine. But if that's all you're doing, okay, there won't be negative consequences. But there's got to be positive karma to have positive consequences, if you know what I mean. So it's not. So in Buddhism, ethics is not just about not doing the negative. In fact, it's much more about doing the positive, cultivating states of mind that lead to happiness. So, having listened to all that, this might confuse you a bit further before it brings clarity. But what do you think? So, from a Buddhist perspective, do you think what would be the kind of karma we're trying to create? What do you think?
Positive.
Positive. Yeah. I have to say, I mean, it's the interesting thing is the answer is only partly right. And that is the interesting thing. Yes, we are trying to create the positive karma, but it's only like an intermediate state. It's only because a positive karma creates the conditions for us to be a happy, healthy human being, which in turn creates the conditions for us to be able to practice more deeply, which in turn creates the condition for what we call the insight to arise. So from a Buddhist point of view, we are trying to go beyond karma altogether. This might sound kind of confusing or fascinating. So what does it mean going beyond karma altogether? Well, I mean, the karma, both positive and negative, arise because we have a sense of self. There's an agency there. But ultimately, what the Buddha saw in his enlightenment, when he gained enlightenment, was that there was actually no fixed, unchanging self at the center of all this experience. So I gave a talk a few weeks ago where I gave this example of, you know, it's like one of these mirrors I saw in Motat. So there's a mirror which reflects everything, but it's got a distortion in it. So everything is distorted, twisted around the center. So, you know, whatever you look through it, it's always twisted around the center. So that's how, in a way, that's an analogy of what our experience is like. It's twisted around the center, the sense of self. But there's nothing actually there. There's no thing there in the center. So ultimately, what we're trying to do is get rid of that distortion altogether, to view the reality in its purest way. And that's when we see that that we do not exist as we think we do, as a separate, independent self. But there's a whole kind of it's very hard to put in words what that experience is like. And, you know, I can't say I fully understand it. But there's different analogies used in the Buddhist literature, things like a sense of interconnectedness. I'll leave it at that for this talk. So what we're trying to do, even by creating the positive through positive ethics, you could say, is we're trying to create the conditions for insight to arise. And it is said, the Buddha, that a fully enlightened human being does not produce any karma at all, positive or negative, because he has there's no sense of a self, there's no ego clinging, there's no sense of an agency doing something. It's what their sense of is a mystery. And sometimes this is talked about as a different order of conditionality called the dharma niyama, but don't get confused. I think perhaps it is what a state of the Buddhahood is like is better communicated by poetry. And again, going back to Dhammapada, there's a couple of verses that to me speak of how a Buddha moves through the world. And I'll just read those out. So, the enlightened one. The enlightened one whose fear is endless, whose victory is irreversible, and after whose victory no defilements remain. By what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one? That enlightened one in whom there is not that ensnaring, entangling craving to lead anywhere, and whose fear is endless, by what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one? So I really like this image of the trackless one. It's like, you know, someone going through water but not causing any ripples whatsoever, or someone walking on sand but not leaving no footprints, good or bad. That doesn't mean a Buddha doesn't do anything. You know, if you look at the life of the Buddha, it's full of all sorts of things, teaching his teachings and communicating it to all sorts of people. Paradoxically, there's no karma produced, good or bad. So that's a mystery I'll leave you with to ponder. Okay, that's all.